It's 9 o'clock on a Thursday night. It's time for the Earth First Update, all the environmental news you can use. Let's start off with an announcement. This Saturday, the California Native Plant Society, Santa Cruz County Chapter Habitat Restoration Team is having their Saturday project, June 7th, from 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Twin Lakes State Beach. More restoration work is needed on this special oak woodland with surrounding coastal prairie grassland. We will continue our work on removal of invasive non-native Hedera helix or English ivy from the understory of a coastal live oak forest. The park's adjacent Swan Lake is a good location for bird watching, with double-crested cormorants, dabbling and diving ducks, a host of coots, and a variety of grebes, herons, and gulls. Join us at this sweet spot along the coast, lending a helping hand for nature. How to get there? From Highway 1, go south towards Watsonville, or north from Watsonville. Exit on Soquel Avenue and get onto the frontage road either by crossing over. Anyway, you want to turn right on 17th Avenue and go down crossing Capitola Road and crossing Bromer. Then you cross the railroad tracks and make an immediate right turn into the Simpkins Family Swim Center. The address there, 979 17th Avenue, and go to the parking lot in the back. They'll meet at the back end of the parking lot and enter Twin Lakes State Beach or State Park or whatever you want to call it from there. All right. The Habitat Restoration Team is a volunteer group working to restore native habitat in the parks and protected lands of Santa Cruz County. Our program provides an opportunity for people to learn about the natural systems that surround them while helping to restore special and wild places. No prior work experience is necessary. Just show up at the park. They welcome individual volunteers from 8 to 80, wear comfortable layered clothing, bring something to drink, and lots of enthusiasm. We work rain or shine. Ain't gonna have no rain this week, but if things get particularly unpleasant, like way too hot, they might call it a day. Tools are provided. Bring gloves and water. For more information, contact the program leader, Linda. Her number, 462-4041. Once again, in the 831 area code, 462-4041. Ask for Linda. Or email to redwoodrn, that's REDWDRN, at packbell.net, or visit their website at cruisecnps.org. That's this Saturday, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., Twin Lakes State Beach. Meet at the back of the parking lot at the Simpkins Family Swim Center at 10 a.m. And moving north, Trey Arrow talks about his guilty plea and his 6.5-year sentence. He might get 4 years off for the time he spent in Canada trying to avoid extradition. A warm blessing to you all. I thank you for your support and for being here today. Some may look at this non-cooperation plea agreement as a victory. Some may see it as a defeat. It's really neither. It's simply another step in this journey as I walk my path of conscience. You see, it's never been about me from before the days of the ledge sit right through till today. This has been and always will be about the commitment to leave our Mother Earth in a healthier, more beautiful state than when I arrived. This is about taking back our power from the government and corporate entities that would have us believe that monetary wealth and the acquisition of material objects is more important than the health of the planet, its people, and the billions of life forms with whom we share this home. This is about being a voice for the trees, our animal friends, the waters, mountains, and blue skies. This is a calling to consider our children, grandchildren, and generations to follow. This is living up to our divine potential. This is an opportunity to be a voice for truth, compassion, and respect in the face of profound corruption and disregard for the sanctity of life that permeates the governments and corporations of the world. Now more than ever, the desperate need to be thoughtful stewards of this earth is upon us. The reality of the enormous detrimental impact humans have on the planet can no longer be ignored. In honor of our Earth Mother and all her sacred creatures, big and small, plant and animal, human and non-human, I ask you to take a deep, hard look at your life and ask yourself one question. Is this what really matters? This government, with its many devices of power and control, has constructed the prison industrial complex not as a means for healing and benefit to society, but as a form of institutionalized slavery that garners big business contracts. Most people are worse off when they leave prison than when they arrived. Instead of rehabilitation and true opportunity for self-improvement, the prison industrial complex is largely a political tool to crush dissent and keep the status quo in place. No being deserves to be locked up in a cage, no matter what their crime. Many government and corporate officials are responsible for the most heinous crimes, yet never spend a day behind bars. I say to those who try to keep the voice of dissent squelched, you may cage my body, but you will never succeed in trapping or containing my mind and spirit. The deeper the oppression, the stronger the light radiates. And so I declare with confidence and passion, as long as I am able, I will do what I can to help preserve the last remaining wild places while helping to restore the damage this one race has caused. Someday in the not-too-distant future, I will meet you on the outside of the prison walls and fences, and together we will heal this earth. Blessings. Thank you. Namaste. Trey Arrow. And no idea when he's actually going to start serving his prison sentence, but it probably won't be too long. I'll let you know when I get that word. Meanwhile, radical snitch in Western arson cases gets probation. In this story by William McCall, Associated Press writer. A radical environmentalist who helped federal officials round up a militant cell of arsonists called The Family has been sentenced to 5 years on probation. After 20 fires across the West and $40 million in damages, federal agents turned Jacob Ferguson into an informant in 2004. He took a tape recorder to meetings with other members of the family and broke what a prosecutor said Tuesday was a wall of silence. Other members also subsequently talked, and one committed suicide in jail. Assistant U.S. Attorney Kirk Engel and said Ferguson's sentencing marks the end of a 10-year investigation, although three of the 15 conspirators remain fugitives. Only through the assistance of Mr. Ferguson did the pieces of this mosaic come together, Engel said. Ferguson, who once had a pentagram tattoo on his head and studied diesel mechanics at Lane Community College, renounced his past on Tuesday. He said the efforts of the family had achieved nothing and the arsonists were fortunate no one was injured or killed. He apologized for the economic damage and disruption that he and others caused for nearly 5 years. I'll never be able to go back and give back what I took away, he said. Ferguson, dressed in a black sweater and black slacks, said he would work with young people to help them avoid getting caught up in violent passions, no matter how noble the cause. Engel said Ferguson had overcome heroin addiction and the experience of growing up with a drug-addicted father who was in and out of prison. Ferguson, now 35, also has gone back to school and is raising his son, Engel said. U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken praised Ferguson's efforts to turn his life around and told him he had had a chance with his own son to break the cycle of abuse and neglect. Defense Attorney Ed Spiney said Ferguson had taken only a tape recorder to dozens of undercover meetings with co-conspirators. Investigators did not monitor the meetings, so he put himself in danger many times, Spiney said. Ferguson has since been the target of threats and has been shunned by the environmental activist community to which he once belonged, Spiney said. The targets of the arsonists included forest ranger stations, meatpacking plants, wild horse corrals, lumber mill offices, research facilities, and an SUV dealer. They were often attributed to the Earth Liberation Front or the Animal Liberation Front. After a federal task force broke up the family, one member, William Rogers, committed suicide in a jail cell in Arizona in 2005. And a Northern California man has been charged in clear-cutting for a pot farm. A Mendocino County man likely faces criminal charges for allegedly destroying 37 fir trees to provide more sunlight for his marijuana garden. Sheriff's officials said 32-year-old Peter Gott cut down some trees that were more than 100 years old. Of the 37 downed trees, officials said 15 were on public property and 10 were on his neighbor's land. Gott holds a prescription for medical marijuana he grows. Gott's property is part of the 2,600-acre forested Brook Trails subdivision. Brook Trails is classified as a park, and none of its 4,000 residents is allowed to cut any tree more than 6 inches in diameter without permission. Mendocino County District Attorney Meredith Lintott says she recommended charges be filed for the damage pending further investigation. And Watsonville plans to cut burned watershed acres. As the smoke clears, a timber sale on city land at Grizzly Flat in the Santa Cruz Mountains may turn partly into a fire salvage operation. The 4,270-acre Summit Fire burned part of the city's timber sale area, according to Mark Pimentel, Administrative Services Director for the City of Watsonville. Long after the fire area has cooled down, the issue of logging in the city's watershed will remain a hot topic, however. Logging, in my mind, is short-sighted for the City of Watsonville, said Jody Frediani, Director of the Central Coast Forest Watch with the Sierra Club. That Grizzly Flat property, while it's not within the City of Watsonville limits, is within their watershed, where they get water from Coralitos Creek, Frediani said. The Grizzly Flat property was previously logged and challenged unsuccessfully by Citizens for Responsible Forest Management, Frediani said. CRFM, a group focused on preserving the ecology of the Santa Cruz Mountains, documented its attempt to intervene in the city's timber management plan at Grizzly Flat. Working closely with a coalition of environmental groups, we spearheaded the attempt to stop the city's planned logging of Grizzly Flat, a late successional forest, that is, it's a recovering second-growth forest, beginning to attain old-growth characteristics that they hold in public trust, the group reported on its website. See, California Department of Forestry approved the plan, and the Board of Forestry subsequently denied the county's appeal, and we filed a lawsuit but did not prevail. While the coalition was unsuccessful in stopping that logging project, we did succeed in raising the public's awareness of key problems in the existing forest practice rules, including the lack of protection for riparian areas and late successional forest habitats, Pimentel said. The Grizzly Flat timber harvest, setting aside from any forest management objectives, promises much-needed revenue to the city. Watsonville faces a $2.2 million deficit this year, he noted, and a predictable revenue is in short supply. There's always a price to pay when you get the income off the sale of trees. You have a drier forest, and you have a forest that's more likely to burn, Ms. Frediani said. And governor declares drought in California in this story by Jennifer Steinhauer of the New York Times. Its reservoir levels receding and its grounds parched. California has fallen officially into drought, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger said Wednesday, warning that the state might be forced to ration water to cities and regions if conservation efforts do not improve. The drought declaration, the first for the state since 1991, includes orders to transfer water from less dry areas to those that are dangerously dry. Governor Schwarzenegger also said he would ask the federal government to aid farmers and press water district cities and local water agencies to accelerate conservation. Drought conditions have hampered farming, increased water rates throughout California, and created potentially dangerous conditions in areas prone to wildfires. The declaration comes after the driest California spring in 88 years, with runoff in river basins that feed most reservoirs at 41% of average levels. It stops short of a water emergency, which would probably include mandatory rationing. Efforts to capture water have also been hampered by evaporation of some mountain snowpacks that provide water and affect, state officials say, of global climate change. A survey this year found the state's snowpack water content was 67% of average, and the Colorado River Basin, from which California draws some water, is coming off a record 8-year drought, continuing the drop in reservoir storage. The drought declaration made when reservoir levels are far higher than they were when Governor Pete Wilson issued a similar statement in 1991 is as much a political statement as a practical one. Governor Schwarzenegger is pressing the legislature to approve an $11.9 billion water bond as part of the state budget to pay for water storage and to fix the state's aging water delivery systems. The governor, a Republican, has said that addressing California's seemingly omnipresent water shortage is one of his most urgent priorities, but his ideas have not passed muster with the legislature in the past. This drought is an urgent reminder of the immediate need to upgrade California's water infrastructure, Mr. Schwarzenegger said Wednesday at a prepared statement. There is no more time to waste because nothing is more vital to protect our economy, our environment, and our quality of life. A bill to require Californians to cut water use roughly 20% recently passed the Assembly. The bill, which requires Senate approval, puts most of the onus on residents and little on the agricultural industries, underscoring tension over conservation between city dwellers and farmers who consume most of the state's water. Across the state, many districts and municipalities are instituting or considering recycling, rationing, and higher fees for excessive use. For instance, Los Angeles officials recently announced their intentions to begin using heavily cleansed sewage to increase drinking water supplies. The East Bay Municipal Utility District and the Long Beach Water Department, serving districts at opposite ends of the state, have made water rationing mandatory. Some cities and regions are rationing, some are doing nothing, and a group of people are in the middle, the director of California's Department of Water Resources, Lester A. Snow, and I'm not making that up, said in a telephone interview. The governor thought it was important to step out in front and get ahead of this. It is in part to avoid an emergency. In a telephone interview later, Governor Schwarzenegger said, "Water is like our gold, and we have to treat it like that." And Pacific Lumber Company proposes another damaging timber harvest plan. In the long list of destructive logging plans, Pacific Lumber is trying to sneak past state review while shielded by bankruptcy proceedings. The Route 09 timber harvest plan deserves special attention. 224 acres of redwood forests are slated to be cut in the Root Creek watershed above Grizzly Creek State Park on Highway 36 along the Van Dusen River. If logged, the timber giant will destroy marbled murrelet habitat and threaten the stability of sensitive slopes above the sediment-impaired Van Dusen River. Two of Route 09's six units, numbered 2 and 3, lie within a translational rotational landslide upslope from the Van Dusen River and are directly above a residential property. As well, one unit is within an active debris slide, further marking this plan as severe and careless forest management. "It's a total affront to our park system," said Noel Sousey, THP monitor for the Environmental Protection Information Center in Garberville. "We have set these beautiful areas aside for a forest sanctuary, but now when you go to the park, you will be bombarded by the sounds of screaming chainsaws and giant helicopters." Since Pacific Lumber filed for bankruptcy some 18 months ago, the company is essentially insulated from litigation because any legal challenge will have to happen in Texas bankruptcy court. During that period, Pacific Lumber has proposed more logging plans that Susi can count on both hands. "There simply isn't enough time to review all of those THPs," he said. "To catch the inconsistencies, we would need several people working full-time sifting through the proposed plans." After years of successful lawsuits, popular movements, and sustained on-the-ground forest defense opposing clear cuts in the redwoods, Pacific Lumber is still liquidating forests, leaving little for future generations. And Greenpeace reports the theft of whale meat by whaling crews. A Greenpeace undercover investigation has revealed evidence of theft involving crew members on board the factory whaling ship Nishin Maru, who are taking the best cuts of whale meat from whales caught during the Japanese Antarctic hunt, smuggling it ashore disguised as personal luggage, and then passing it on to traders for illegal sale. Informers told Greenpeace that senior crew and officials from the company operating the fleet, Kyoto Senpaku, are turning a blind eye to the thefts, allowing them to continue for decades. One informer associated with Kyoto Senpaku told Greenpeace that officials from the Institute of Cetacean Research, or ICR, who were on board the Nishin Maru, knew of the scandal and did nothing. The ICR is a government-authorized nonprofit organization that oversees the Japanese whale hunt, which is conducted under the International Whaling Commission's Scientific Research Whaling Provision. "The information we have gathered indicates that the scale of the scandal is so great it would be impossible for the ship's operating company, Kyoto Senpaku, and the ICR not to know," said Junichi Sato, Greenpeace Japan Whales Campaign Coordinator. The Japanese government claims the whaling program, which has been going on for more than 20 years, is a lawful activity and invests a subsidy of more than 500 million yen, or about $5 million per year, from Japanese taxpayers. Greenpeace activists in Tokyo put a box of whale meat illicitly removed by the crew of the Nishin Maru on display Thursday before handing it over to the public prosecutor's office in Tokyo as evidence. The environmental organization is now asking for a full public inquiry to ascertain the level of corruption within the whaling program. "They are turning their back on large-scale corruption and theft of taxpayers' money. What we need to know now, through a full public inquiry is who else is profiting from the whaling program. Who else has allowed this fraud to continue, demanded Sato. In addition to a public inquiry, Greenpeace is calling for an end to taxpayer subsidies for the whale hunt and withdrawal of Kyoto Senpaku's license to hunt whales. The Greenpeace investigation was triggered when the organization was contacted by an informer who used to be involved in the whaling program and claimed to have information about the Japanese government's research whaling program. The credibility of the witness was verified through secondary interviews supporting his claims and Greenpeace's own investigation, states a Greenpeace reporter on the undercover investigation. Working from information given by former and current Kyoto Senpaku employees, Greenpeace documented the offloading of smuggled whale meat into a special truck in full view of Kyoto Senpaku officials and crew members when the Nishin Maru docked on April 15th. The consignment was documented by Greenpeace activists once it left the ship and tracked to a depot in Tokyo. One of four boxes destined for the same private address was then intercepted in order to verify the contents and establish the fraud. The consignment notes claimed the box contained cardboard, but in fact held 23.5 kilograms, about 51.8 pounds, of salted prime whale meat worth about $3,000 U.S. One informer told Greenpeace that dozens of crew members take as many as 20 boxes each. For the Greenpeace investigation established that more than 23 crew members sent at least 93 boxes of personal baggage to at least 30 destinations. Further inquiries in pubs and restaurants in a number of different locations around Japan confirmed that they were expecting the imminent delivery of whale meat from this year's hunt, despite the fact that Japanese Fisheries Agency and the Institute of Cetacean Research do not release the whale meat for sale before the end of June, Greenpeace said. The whaling program in the Southern Ocean Whale Sanctuary is funded by Japanese taxpayers, and they have a right to know who is profiting from their money, said Sato. When Greenpeacers inquired about the diverted meat to the Fisheries Agency of Japan, which has jurisdiction over whale meat distribution, the agency claimed only officially sanctioned whale meat is offloaded from the Nishin Maru. The Japanese whaling program has already been shamed internationally for its lack of scientific credibility. Embarrassed by the generation of vast stockpiles of whale meat few want to eat, and is now embroiled in a scandal at home for being corrupt, Sato said. It is time for the whaling program to be stopped and public money spent on something more honorable. Japan has been carrying out research whaling since 1987, the year after the International Whaling Commission declared a moratorium on all commercial whaling to allow the decimated populations of whales to recover. All right. And Indonesia's two-year-old mud volcano is still spewing. 2 years after it oozed into life, Indonesia's mud volcano is still spewing toxic sludge across the Javanese countryside at the rate of 60 Olympic swimming pools a day. And the more homes and farms that disappear beneath its stinking gray goo, the louder the calls for justice from hundreds of displaced families who are awaiting compensation. There is always a fear that even where we are staying will be flooded with mud. Recently, the dike at Renakenganggu subsided 2 yards, and new gas leaks are everywhere, said Sunarto, who lives near the mud flow. When the wind blows westward, we can smell the strong odor from here. It seems like there's no end, but there would be if only the government would act more swiftly. Like something from a B-list 1950s horror movie, Sunarto's nightmare began 2 years ago on Thursday when the mud first emerged from beneath the earth and began to swallow a corner of the Sidoarjo district in East Java. It came from a gas well where Limpindo Brontas, a company owned by the family of billionaire welfare minister Aburizal Bakri, was drilling without proper equipment. Limpindo says the disaster was triggered by an earlier earthquake in the central Javanese city of Yogyakarta, which says it squeezed open the earth's pores and brought a sea of methane-filled mud squirting to the surface. But while the authorities argue over who, if anyone, is to blame, the mud marches on, burying villages and making people ill with foul plumes of highly concentrated methane gas. Word officials have said it gets so bad they are afraid to cook in case the flammable cloud explodes. The latest data from March this year shows around 640 hectares, roughly 1,500 acres, or nearly 2.5 square miles of land is flooded by the mud, said Ahmad Zulkarnian, spokesman for the government team which is responding to the disaster. Up to 150,000 cubic meters, or equivalent of 60 Olympic-sized swimming pools of hot sludge, is gushing from the volcano's steaming lips every day, he said. So far, all efforts to stem the mud flow, which included dropping huge concrete balls down the hole, have failed. 12 villages have been affected, and at least 36,000 people have been forced to flee their homes. Two villages, Kendungbendo and Rinkingabongo, are completely inundated. The other 10 are partially affected, said Zulkarnain. Aerial photos of the region show nothing but rooftops poking through the thick slime. Ignoring the company's excuses, President Susilo Bambang Yudhoyono said last year ordered Lapindo to pay 3.8 trillion rupiah, that's about $420 million, for compensation and mud containment efforts. The government has also decided to allot 70 billion rupiah, or about $77 million, in stakes to the relief and rebuilding effort, although it is unclear how much of that money has been dispersed. Many locals complain, however, that it is too little and too late. Lapindo executive Uniwati Teryana told AFP the company had already spent 3.2 trillion rupiah on land compensation and rebuilding, even though a court ruled in December the mud flow was a natural disaster. Lapindo patriarch Balkri was named Indonesia's richest man in a report by Globe Asia magazine this week, with an estimated net worth of $9.2 billion amassed through energy, property, and communication investments. Most of the 12,039 claimants to the company's money, those who could produce documentation of ownership, have received a first installment of 20% of the value of their land, Teryana said. The remainder will be paid later this month, she promised. The rest who cannot show a land ownership certificate will be resettled with the same land area as the one they lost, she said, adding that more than 1,000 claimants would be compensated in this way. But another 582 households, or 2,000 people, are still living in makeshift shelters, refusing both payment schemes and demanding that Lapindo buy their lost homes so they can rebuild elsewhere. Sonarto, his wife, two children, and two other relatives are those among refusing to budge, even though Lapindo has stopped giving them daily food rations and despite having to buy clean drinking water. Lapindo offered to relocate us, but unless they give us guarantees about when we can actually see and move into our new homes, I won't give them my documents, Sunardo said. And we thank the Agence France Presse for that story. And in our final story tonight, Moose on the Loose in Scotland, Are Wolves to Follow? In the story by Sarah Marsh, with editing by John Boyle and Sarah Ledwith of the Reuters News Service. The howl of a wolf echoes through the glen, lumbering bears fish in the lochs, and moose amble through the pine forest. This is multimillionaire Paul Lister's vision for his estate in the Scottish Highlands, and his grand scheme is already underway. Last year, the British businessman spent £16,000, about $32,000, buying a pair of moose in Sweden and flying them to Scotland on a chartered plane. Hulda and Hercules now roam a bracken and heather carpeted 450-acre enclosure in the Allendale Wilderness Reserve alongside a newly released wild boar. His aim is to both restore a section of the deforested and depopulated highlands to its former glory by releasing once native species into his vast Allendale Wilderness Reserve, and to turn a profit by charging people to visit. Allendale is about a restoration project, said Lister, 49, the son of a founder of a UK furniture retailer, MFI. It's not about conservation. We haven't got a lot to conserve. Only about 1% of Scotland's native pine woods remain, while many other habitats have been degraded or lost due to changes in climate and farming and forestry over the last 5,000 years or so, according to the conservation charity Trees for Life. Lister believes if bears and wolves are reintroduced, business at his luxury eco-resort would increase tenfold, thereby creating 100 jobs on the estate, generating £7 million of income a year, and revitalizing the local economy. I'm not just some crazed wolf man, he told Reuters. Farmers, ramblers, and neighboring landowners remain skeptical, and the reintroduction of wolves would have many complex consequences. But conservationists and naturalists are fascinated by the experiment, which is costing Lister about £800,000 a year in capital expenditure and making a further £100,000 trading loss. Scientists from Rutgers University's Wildlife Conservation Research Unit are carrying out a 3-year project on the reserve, trying to monitor the impact of the boars and moose on bracken and new seedbeds for trees. What he's doing is almost like a scientific experiment, privately funded, so as it is to no cost to the taxpayer, to see what would happen if we rewilded and restored parts of the old Caledonian forest in Scotland, said Richard Morley of the Wolves and Humans Foundation. Even if Lister is not able to see all his plans through, he has ignited a public debate about the restoration of the Scottish Highlands and the reintroduction of wolves into Scotland. An academic report published last year lent credibility to Lister's plan. Scientists from Norway and from the Imperial College in London found that wolves would help control the deer population, reducing the need for expensive culling, reed hunting, and preventing overgrazing and the trampling of saplings. Morley said interest in wolf introduction had surged since the 1960s as people became more concerned about the environment and saw conservation efforts abroad. There is a feeling that we should demonstrate that we have changed and we can now live with an animal that was exterminated in the British Isles, he said. Wolves were once common in Britain, but as a large predator and threat to livestock, were steadily exterminated from south to north, with the last wolf said to have perished in the Scottish Highlands in the mid-18th century. The wolf is still tied up in Highlands folklore, said Ian Ross, a spokesman for the Scottish National Heritage, the government body in charge of conservation and restoration. There is a historical character called the Wolf of Badenoch, who was a Highland clan chieftain, who was a raider and a rampager. And though it is gone from living memory, there are lots of songs and poetry which talk about the wolf, he said. Ross said there were many people making a vocal case for the reintroduction of wolves, but it was not a priority for the Scottish National Heritage, whose many other projects underway included a proposed reintroduction of the beaver. Because it is a large carnivore and a predator, the reality of it is slightly different to something like the beaver, which is a mild woodland creature that would probably run away if you came upon it, he said. Everyone agrees that managing the reintroduction of wolves could be complicated and costly. The government would need to provide compensation to farmers for killed livestock, and it would have to carefully monitor the wolf population, which can multiply and spread rapidly. Even Lister says if he does overcome all the red tape and succeeds in releasing wolves onto his estate, he will probably have to have them neutered. And that's it for the Earth First Update for this week. If you'd like to hear a rebroadcast of this or any previous Earth First Update, go to the following web page, http://h2opodcast.com/earthfirst.html, and the E and the F in Earth First are capitalized. It matters. Once again, that webpage, http://h2opodcast.com/earthfirst.html, with the E and the F capitalized. And we thank H2O Podcast for archiving and allowing those shows to be downloaded. Earth First Update is a production of Earth First Radio and is produced in the studios of Free Radio Santa Cruz. I want to thank you for listening. Earth First Update will be back on the air next Thursday evening at 9 o'clock.